Estelle Morris, former Secretary of State for Education and Skills.
Thank you. Was history one of your loves or hates when you were at school?
No, I liked it. Not to say I did well at it, but I enjoyed it. I tended to like things with a narrative, I think, you know, that had a storyline to it. So I think my memories are very positive, both in junior school and secondary.
Was it taught in a traditional form?
I would imagine so, yes. I mean, I went to a girls' grammar school, so I would imagine, yes. I mean, I can't recall doing project work or themes. I think we went through the years. So, you know, you did the Industrial Revolution, you did the Agricultural Revolution, did the Tudors, yeah. Not that it put me off, but I think it was traditionally taught. And fairly not modern history either. You know, I can't remember doing anything about last century.
When you were teaching, how was history regarded as a subject in school?
When I first started teaching, we were into integrated humanities, so it wasn't taught as a separate subject. So I was teaching social studies, but we did it integrated with social studies, history and geography.
That was in the 70s?
I was in the 70s and into the 80s. And so the way, I may end up answering more than one of your questions here, the way they did it was a term on each, or an aspect of a project on each, I don't think was very satisfactory, to tell you the truth. And you tended to get a teacher who was specialist in some other part of the humanities, so I ended up teaching some of the history, but I wouldn't call myself a history teacher, you know, I was a social scientist. So, but I would say it was valued, yes, and we had children go on to A-level, so, you know, and get GCSE.
So you actually taught some history?
Just trying to work, only in terms of it was part of integrated humanities, that's all.
But did you feel lack of confidence in doing that?
Not in the way I would feel a lack of confidence in maths or physics. It's not conceptually difficult in the way maths or physics is, or modern foreign languages would be. And I did like it, I do like history, so I, you know, it wasn't a pain to have to really revise it, but I was really conscious I was by no means a specialist, and therefore my depth of knowledge wasn't as much as it should do. I didn't teach a lot, I did mainly the social studies, but there were times when I was called upon to do the history unit.
Do you think it was an important subject in the curriculum?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can't, yes, and I'd be amazed if anybody said no. I mean, the notion that any society or individual or family or community doesn't want an understanding of its history, you know, would be a very strange view to hold. I think there's so much in present day history that tells us how important histories of communities are. So I do feel it's very important, partly because of that sense of identity, and partly because, you know, I do think it helps you to understand the present, and some of the challenges, you know, the world faces today have also been faced in the past.
When you were opposition spokesperson on education from 1995 to 1997, what were your major concerns in relation to the national curriculum at that time?
It's very difficult to look back, and it's very difficult to divide, you know, the years of your thinking, 12 years on.
Really, the period after you first came into Parliament, then from 1992 onwards. The national curriculum was quite big news in education at that time.
Looking back, I mean, don't forget, at that time it still wasn't settled. You know, they were still changing things like the technology curriculum or the food technology curriculum. There's all that unsettling. So I think I left teaching in 92 before the national curriculum had hit my stage of the secondary school, so I didn't actually teach the national curriculum either. I think my thoughts in those days were less of content and more of government inefficiency in introducing it. I think it was more a political view like that. And I think by the time we got to opposition, our thoughts were all on literacy and numeracy, because we'd already decided that, you know, that was going to be sort of two of our priorities.
That came quite early on, that decision about literacy and
Yeah, well, the Michael Barber was doing the workforce report, so that report was published while we were still in opposition. So that the notion of doing that and having the literacy hour was definitely formed in opposition. We were absolutely ready to go with it when we were in government. So I can only assume that David Blunkett had really worked on it a long way. But I don't think our talks about the national curriculum were qualitatively how much of one thing and how much of the other thing should be done.
Well, that brings us neatly on to the next question, really, about the literacy and numeracy hours and the teaching of citizenship, which were two of the sort of flagship policies introduced by David Blunkett when you were school standards minister. So how did you feel about those policies, and how do you feel about the implementation of them?
I thought they're excellent policies. I mean, they weren't done together. Literacy and numeracy, you know, were done by the, you know, our standards and effectiveness unit and rolled out. Citizenship was very much a personal wish of David's to pursue, and he asked the QCA to do it to begin with. And I think we might have ended up doing it in-house because the QCA weren't very keen to do it, actually. It wasn't one of their most glorious moments. I think the citizenship came after the literacy and numeracy strategy. And you could argue, but I don't think this is by no means the main reason, you could argue that it was a balance to the literacy and numeracy, because people were saying there's too much literacy and numeracy, there's no room for, you know, the better gore children as citizens, you know, how you prepare them for adulthood. So I think you could see citizenship as a counterbalance to the orthodoxy, you know, to the very strict implementation of the literacy and numeracy hours. In truth, it was David's obsession, and it's what he wanted to do when he came into Parliament, and, you know, when he became a minister, he was going to do it. I think they were introduced fine. Would I do it differently now? Yes. But I'd be silly if we hadn't learnt something. You know, literacy and numeracy was very top down, and I think it needed to be at that time. I think we could have had a different approach 5, 6 years, 7 years later, and we didn't. But at that time, I think there needed to be some sort of shock that actually said to teachers, you do actually have to use a pedagogy that's got evidence it works. You can't just do what you want or what you've always done. You do actually have to, you know, train yourself in things that work. I think its weakness was there's more than one thing that works. And had we offered a number of, you know, ways of teaching phonics-based reading or best practice in numeracy, it might have been better. But I don't know. I don't know. I think the worst teachers would have found a way around not doing any. You know, there was an element of changing the system in that. The citizenship was implemented in a very different way. And I think the problem with a citizenship curriculum for me is that, and I think you have to be a teacher to understand this really, you can draw up a curriculum and you can tell schools they've got to do it. It doesn't mean it's taught. It's not assessed. There's not an exam in it. It's not, you know, it doesn't score high on the Ofsted inspection framework. And I think there was a feeling that if every school taught citizenship, well, then children would learn citizenship. And if those two things were true, education would be easier and teaching would be, you know, a lot less demanding than it is. And so I think in those early days that all schools addressed citizenship, but I don't think they all taught citizenship or taught it in a way that enabled children to learn it. And that's because there weren't as, you know, sufficiently qualified teachers, and it didn't have a big space on the curriculum. But I think it gradually began to change the culture, and I suspect now it's much more embedded into what happens. But I think what's interesting about those is there were literacy, numeracy, and citizenship were two or three different things that were started, but they were started in different ways. You know, they had different strategies for introducing them into schools, and it's interesting to see what happened to each of them.
I mean, there are lots of interesting issues you raise there. One about the difficulty government has in making something work from the top down,
yeah,
at school level. And another is the problem for subjects which aren't assessed.
Yeah.
And history sort of falls into both areas. Teachers, on the one hand, saying their subject is being eroded because it's,
yeah,
not assessed in the core. And
but that, hang on, that's only... do you mean at primary?
No.
Because it's...
even at, well,
it was assessed at Key Stage 3, wasn't it?
It's assessed informally by...
yeah.
But it was never...
teacher assessment. Teacher assessment,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, teacher assessment.
Mm.
And of course, it's not compulsory.
Compulsory after 14. Mm.
And those sorts of issues have tended to...
you see, I'm not sure history was ever compulsory. I go back to my grammar school days, and you chose history or geography. I mean, just let me think, you chose you all did French and you chose Latin or German. And when we came to what was year four, year 10 now, I think, yeah, I'm just challenging whether it's the national curriculum that has really made it non-compulsory after 14. It wasn't compulsory before then.
It wasn't. The problem seems to have come. In fact, history seems to have been helped by the national curriculum.
I would have thought so, because it's there until 14.
But it seems to be the creeping crowding of the curriculum, which brings me to the citizenship issue. And citizenship isn't just the only thing, it's the skills agenda.
Yeah.
That perhaps has pushed out other subjects which are regarded as, you know, less easy to deliver, or those sorts of issues, because that's been the easing up in the national curriculum.
Well, it could, but let's take those subjects you're talking about. Let's guess what they may be. Media studies, citizenship,
business studies,
economics.
Diplomas.
Mm. None of them are compulsory either.
No.
So it's not as though, there's very few things compulsory on the national curriculum, in actual fact, especially when you get to key stage four. So I think, you did say this, you didn't say what I'm about to say, you didn't say, you know, it gets squeezed out because you have to do the others, you didn't say that. But I think what you sort of implied was that schools opt to do the other things. And I think there's an element of truth in that. And I think, you know, we need to work out why. And I think sometimes I think they feel the other things are more modern and will engage children. And I think that's wrong. That means we're teaching history badly in that case. You know, it's just as easy to engage children with history. In fact, I think it's easier in some ways than it is some of those modern subjects. I don't think history suffers from the issue of not being valued by universities. It's really, it's very secure there in terms of how it's viewed in the academic world. But I think the real thing is that, or one of the things that's more difficult to overcome is, all those other subjects are because the world's changed. You know, and IT, childcare, media studies, let's just take those three. You know, you turn the Today programme on and there's a crisis on this, that or the other. You know, why have we got so many adults who can't parent effectively? So I told them, well, why aren't schools teaching anything about it? Media studies, you know, it really is an issue. They have 24-hour-a-day media and people's, you know, absolute necessity to understand what the media's about. So, and ICT is obvious. And I think that to some extent we've not been tough enough at saying, well, do we want to teach that? And what's the consequences if we do teach it? So I think to some extent it's a quite legitimate response to a changing world and a wish to motivate children who, quite honestly, when I was a kid, would have left school at 15 anyway. So you wouldn't have had to motivate them in key stage four in any case.
Are you arguing that history for less able students is not...
Oh, I think it's brilliant. Oh, no, absolutely brilliant. I think, no. But, and it's great, but I think some schools, I think they're wrong. I think they're absolutely wrong. But I think they think that things like media studies will motivate them better. And I don't agree with them. But I think that's what some schools feel. Because otherwise, the other argument is that it's easier to pass. And I've not seen the evidence for that, and I didn't want to say that because I don't know whether it's easier to pass or not. I've seen some of the media studies questions and they're quite hard, so I've no reason to think they're easier to pass. So I'm trying to work out why it is that, let's just stick with the media studies, why would a school choose to offer media studies and not make a child do history in key stage four? Because they've got the freedom to make them do history. No one is making them offer media studies. What's more, universities don't particularly like media studies, and mums and dads would think history is a better qualification. So the odds are stacked against media studies, and yet it gets through. And I think somehow in that, what's going on in a school's mind at that point, that they are happy for children to choose between history and media studies, or history and something else. And I think it's understanding why schools are what they're thinking at that point. Because when I look at the outside structure, I don't think it's telling them to go one way or the other. Does that make sense?
Yes, it seems to be the thinking that's led the opposition at the moment to highlight the need to protect history and perhaps even foreground it more in students.
Well, what does protect it mean?
Well,
make it compulsory at stage four.
Well, they've been talking about that.
This government, the party you said are going to leave everything to the professionals, abolish the strategies. What
so
else are they going to make?
Contradictory.
Contradictory. What else are you going to make? Can't you make the same argument for geography?
Underlying that argument about the traditional subjects is the issue that you yourself raised about a community needing to know its history.
Absolutely agree with that.
And that children
absolutely
might be losing something.
Absolutely right.
So how do you square that if schools have got this choice and yet they're not choosing to?
I think that if it's taught and really taught well from 5 till 14... I don't think I mind if it's optional at 14 to 16, as long as the key things have been. Because I think we waste too much time at key stage three. I think we could fit at least year 10 work into years 7, 8 and 9. So let's say you could do that. You'd actually then only be missing 2 terms of year 11. And you'd have done all the curriculum. I really believe that can happen. I think the pace of learning is too slow in years 7 and 8. I think you could kaleidoscope. I think you've got a choice. You could either put the 3-year key stage 2 into 2 years, which lots of schools do, or you could put the 4 years, years 7, 8, 9 and 10, into 3 years 7, 8 and 9. I mean, there's lots of patterns on that. I'm trying to defend not making it compulsory at 16. Because if you're going to make it compulsory at 14... I think I accept the same for geography, for some social science. I think I accept the same for citizenship, certainly. I accept the same for science. And I don't know when I stop. And also I accept that we have to constantly look at what else the curriculum can offer. And for some youngsters, a diploma type practical learning will be what they need at that moment in time. And so it is a crowded key stage four. And I think that's the truth, that our children are so diverse at key stage four. We've never had to meet all their needs before. I mean, that's really important, we don't forget that. It was only in 1974 that we raised the school leaving age to 16. You know, these kids have only been with us during my teaching lifetime. We haven't done very well by them. And so, you know, this wish to look at key stage, look at 14 to 19 and see what children really need, I think it's a genuine thing, and we should do that. And my reluctance in saying make history compulsory to 16 is I don't know, I think I'd have to say yes to geography and other things, and I then don't know how much space it leaves in a curriculum for children to and I think anybody who says they would make it compulsory to 16 has to justify why all children, and you mean all children, you mean the most naughtiest pest in the class who doesn't want to turn up, you know, who makes life a misery for anyone else because the classroom situation doesn't work for him or her. More likely to be him, but just doesn't work for them. You mean the immigrant kid who's only come to the school in year 9? That's how I'm going to say. You mean the immigrant child who's only come to school in year 9? You mean the child who can't read and write despite 10 years of education? Are you going to make all them do history between the ages of 14 and 16? That's what compulsory means. And I think one of the challenges is, in order to give that group of children flexibility, to give the school flexibility for that group of children, you end up giving them flexibility for all children, because it's very difficult to draw the line. What we used to have was a system of exceptions. Well, everyone's going to do it unless you apply for an exception. You've got the government, this school, applying to the government for an exception to teach John Smith history in years 10 and 11. That's why we made modern languages optional. It's a transfer of power and a transfer of responsibility from the centre to the school. That's what freeing the curriculum up is. Now, I would never do it. I'm a believer in the national curriculum. I would never free it up totally. That's why I'm so keen on absolute compulsion between 5 and 14. That's the call. That's government's duty to parents, to make sure their children have access to that knowledge and that skills. But I am persuaded by greater flexibility at 14, not in terms of English, maths, you know, and the things that are compulsory now. But once you go beyond that, I think you're into a list of subjects that have got equal right to be compulsory. And I don't think it's the real way out. And I don't believe any, I'd be amazed if any government just made history compulsory.
Thank you. When you were appointed Secretary of State for Education and Skills, were there concerns about the curriculum at that time?
Yes, to do with overcrowdedness. There's no doubt about it. It's to do with overcrowdedness because we add things to it all the time. I mean, I took the decision to free up Key Stage 4 tremendously and, you know, not universally popular. But on the one hand, we got teachers saying to us, we can't make secondary school education relevant for all children because you won't give us the flexibility to do what we know these children need. And so we did give them the flexibility at Key Stage 4, but not at Key Stage 3. So the debates when I was Secretary of State were all about whether we could give flexibility there. And the other debate, of course, is that we were trying to get something cohesive into 14 to 19. See, that's the other thing with Key Stage 4. It's not the end of compulsory schooling in a way. It's the join between compulsory schooling and those vital 2 years of post-compulsory education, which might be compulsory in the years to come. And that's why I see the curriculum much more as 5 to 14 and 14 to 19. So when I was Secretary of State, it was that was the nature of our concerns. It was about trying to get 14 to 19 cohesive work, especially in vocational qualifications, and trying to give the schools the freedom they said they needed at Key Stage 4. I mean, the debates elsewhere were still whether literacy and numeracy were crowding out some of the other subjects. Mm.
That's still an issue today, isn't it, about that literacy and numeracy?
It is, but I think it's in the heads of teachers. I think it need not be, and confident teachers would just say to you, of course it doesn't crowd it out, of course it doesn't. Less confident teachers do too much of it. An hour for literacy and an hour for numeracy a day, that's all that's required. That's
that was the 2:30
in the morning.
Robin Alexander's argument, wasn't it, about that you could do a broad and balanced curriculum.
Of course you could, yeah.
To what extent should concerns about national identity or ethnic or social diversity affect the history taught in schools?
Oh, they've got to do. I mean, history is cultural centric, isn't it? I never realised as much older that atlases are drawn with your own country in the middle. I never knew that. You know, I just thought, you know, the kingdom was somehow in the middle of the map. So, you know, all humanities and social sciences, I think, are pretty, you know, centric to your own nation. It's vital. It's not just vital because we've got a multiracial society, but it's having a multiracial society that's made us realise, I think, how partial teaching of history can be. If we didn't have a multiracial society, we ought to have regard to feelings of identity. What I don't believe, though, is we don't make it softer because we don't protect people. You know, I'm not into going soft on bits of history because it might mean somebody's national identity is quite difficult to come to terms with. I would like to give a stupid example. If you had German children in the class, you're not going to not say how bad Hitler was just because of their sensitivities. And I know for the record that Germany's very much faced up to that now, but, you know, a similar thing. So history, how do you know about your national identity unless it is through history? My feeling of historically what the British did, it's all through history lessons, all through reading history. There's no other way, once you get past two generations, which could go by word of mouth. So history has actually formed my view of what my nation has been like, which in turn must influence a little bit in what my identity is like as a British person, British citizen.
But it can present issues in terms of a different perspective.
It can indeed.
So would you say it ought to be different in different places?
No.
Or within different communities?
No, no.
There's a way of blending
together. You've got to do. I mean, I'm not a good enough history teacher, I'm not a good enough teacher now to know how to do that, but it cannot be an answer to, you know, teach one group of children. I know this is exaggerated, but it can't be an answer to teach one group of children the same bit of history from one perspective and another from another. you're just breeding division between those two groups. They live in neighbouring roads in the same community, or even neighbouring houses in the same street. You can't do that. We've got to come to an understanding of what happened in the past. And it's not that we have to learn to agree, but I think we have to learn to tolerate. And let's take Catholics and Protestants. You know, there's a history of our nation that puts Catholicism in a good light, and there's a history of our nation that puts Anglicanism in a good light. And then what we know is, you know, both have had their good times and both have had the times of which they will not be proud. And if you only teach part of that to each of those communities, it's just a recipe for disaster. So, the only way I would accommodate that is I do see if you've got a school that's mainly Afro-Caribbean black or a school that's mainly Poles, it would be silly not at some point during the history to spend a fair amount of time on slavery and immigrant groups or Eastern Europe and what happened with the Russians or our behaviour in World War I and World War II. So I think that's what, if I look around my class and find I've got a lot of children from a particular national identity, I would want to make sure that a bit of history that particularly affected them was taught and was taught well. But I think we've got to learn together if we're going to live together, I think.
There has been a new criteria on diversity that's been introduced into the history curriculum.
And what does it say?
Well, it recommends the teaching of it mandates the teaching of diversity, but it doesn't define what diversity
is.
So it depends on the school, how they interpret it.
Yeah. It's very difficult to teach history without doing diversity, isn't it?
One could argue that the sort of history that you and I studied at school
didn't
tackle diversity.
No, it didn't. It didn't tackle it, but I mean, we just knew that everyone who invaded Britain was bad, and we were good.
Yes.
I mean, that's
yes. The Irish would always be seen as victims.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or troublemakers.
Yeah,
so
the Scottish were too warlike, and you're right.
So we have moved away from that.
Yeah.
In some cases, people would argue, almost despite the national curriculum as it was originally written, that flexibility has been given.
Yeah.
And that's something that you feel the government's proud of, having given the flexibility.
Well, what did it used to say?
Well, obviously there was a high level of British content. There still is, 75% at one point, after 1995.
So if you did the World War, would that count as British content?
Yes.
I do think they need their own country's history. I do think they need British history. But I don't think... See, I think I was thinking more of when British history happened with somebody from another country. So British history and French history came together. I think that's what I was thinking, as it would do in a lot of cases. But it surely should be predominantly British, I think. I'd be very interested to hear the arguments against that.
The arguments would be based on the idea that nationalism is a dangerous thing, and that we're all world citizens and we should appreciate, if you like, the development.
What's your starting point? I mean, a child's starting point is, when a child's born, their identity is them. For those 5 years, it's no more than them and their family. Then it's them, the family, and their infant school teacher. You know the message. And I do think you've got to be comfortable. It's got to be... I don't think you could start history and immediately... do Africa or discovery Australasia. So I think it's a case of when you do it. But I think it's how you teach it as much as anything else. I mean, British history could be taught to people in a way that's wholly damaging to their view of the rest of the world. I think that's what I was thinking about more. Whereas, you know, it can also be taught that in a way that would make them better citizens. But should they leave school with no knowledge of the rest of the world? No, they shouldn't. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We've been so omnipresent as a nation throughout history. I suppose you cover a bit of it naturally.
Education is widely seen by politicians as one of the main agents of change in society. What implications does that have for the curriculum, and in particular for history? You see it as an agent of change.
Yes, I do. I do, in that... from a number of points. It is for the individual in terms of the qualifications and things like that. So it's definitely an agent of change there. And it's also an agent of change that if we wanted to, let's take South Africa. I suppose in the days of apartheid, the history would have said that it was white man's land and the only way they could keep it was during a system of apartheid, and that was about, they would have been taught that that was about opportunity for both races to develop separately. And apartheid wasn't there centuries and centuries and centuries. So there's a good example of how education can bring about change in an awful way, you know, a terrible way. So if you've got, I don't know if this was happening in Britain now, or I hope not, so if you were determined to teach a particular aspect of cultural identity, hate the blacks, hate the Asians, I mean, the BNP got the hand on the history syllabus. I think a lot of people would grow up being you know, dislike of people who are not white. So it could be an agent of change in that way, and that'd be awful. But if that's true, it could be an agent of change in terms of bringing up a more tolerant nation and a more tolerant citizenry. So I think it can be an agent of change in that way. So I'd say it's on that level. So it's on the individual level about opportunity. It's on that level about governments or countries deciding what message, what stories they want to pass from one generation to another. And that's absolutely crucial, and that comes through into history. And then I think history well taught, with proper regard to content and approach and pedagogy, I do think has the capacity to bring up more better rounded citizens.
You mean from the point of view of them being able to think about it?
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Finally,
yeah.
Last question. Recently, organisations representing history teaching in schools have expressed concern about the downgrading of knowledge acquisition and specialist teaching in favour of the broad skills and competences curriculum, particularly at Key Stage 3. What's your view of that? Should skills be learned within subjects, or should subjects be subordinated to the learning of skills? I'm thinking here of the new personal learning and thinking skills agenda.
Yeah. I think thinking skills is a great idea. You know, why wouldn't we want to learn to think? I think it's a fantastic idea, thinking skills. So I'm in a difficult position because I agree with that, but I worry about watering down subject boundaries. Always have done. Partly because I'm old enough to have taught in the 70s. When we went for integrated humanities, and I saw firsthand how subjects were ignored and children didn't get the grasp of those subjects. And we went to teaching them separately, so we did give children a good grounding in each subject as part of the national curriculum. I believe passionately in that. Now, whether now schools are such and the quality of teachers is so much improved, which it is, that it can again integrate them and wind knowledge and skill, knowledge and fact round the teaching of skills, I don't know. I just know it didn't happen when I tried to do it. And I'm not for a minute surmising that things don't move on. But I am a bit worried. I like to see something on the timetable called history. And I like a child to know that they've learned history. I like them to be able to go home and say, I've learnt something in history. Because that's a common language. We all know what that means. And I'm not sure why we insist on things that are somehow hide the history facts and the history knowledge. So if the curriculum at the moment is overcrowded and there's not enough room for the teaching of skills, we should worry about that. But we shouldn't, as a response, say we don't need to teach the facts. I'm not one who believes that if you teach the skills, they'll look up the facts themselves. They will eventually, but only when you've excited them so much with the facts that they actually want to go and look up the facts. And if you just teach them skills of thinking or skills of exploration or skills of reporting, why would they ever want to go and open a history book? Because they don't know what's inside the pages. So I do have a bit of concern, but I hold back my judgment because I have a great deal of confidence that this generation of teachers is far better than when I taught up to 1992. And let's hope we get it right this time, because I'd hate to think that we went through the errors that we went when we concentrated just on skills and not subject knowledge in the 70s.
Thank you very much.